UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Welcome to the show. Our topic today is lumbar stenosis, and my guest is Dr. Thomas Stainer. He's a clinical professor in neurosurgery at the Greystone Neuroscience Center office of UAB Medicine, and one of the few neurological specialists in the country who's both board certified in neurosurgery and neurology. Dr. Stainer, how do you interface with the downtown campus? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we're located at the Greystone Neuroscience Center. And we have some abilities that make us very important for patients. And that is that, first of all, we're able to get them in very quickly and to evaluate them completely. If they're surgical, we can get access for our elective patients, even on a priority basis. For instance, if the patient brings images, say an MRI scan or a CD, I can place them into a program called iSight, and my neurosurgical colleagues downtown can review them simultaneously with me. We could discuss the pathology, my neurosurgical thoughts, and we can get them in. Sometimes patients travel long distance to see us. It is not uncommon for those patients that are urgent that we can get them in the same day to be further evaluated by the actual surgeon that will be doing the procedure. So I think this efficiency is a very good option for patients that are looking to be seen not only quickly but want a complete evaluation.
Tell us a little bit about lumbar stenosis and what you're seeing and what you used to see, and are you seeing it differently today?
Well, let's talk about spinal stenosis, and in this regards, I'll talk about not only lumbar but cervical, even some thoracic, because it's throughout the entire spine. What is the stenosis? Well, I think most physicians are familiar with stenosis being a narrowing, if you will, like a tube structure becomes narrower than it was normally. And this commonly occurs when we age. But I'd like you to think about this as a Christmas tree, so that the trunk of the Christmas tree would be the spinal canal. Where the branches come out would be where the nerve roots come out through the nerve foramen. And especially in the lumbar area, there's something where there's compression of the shoulder of the branches even, which we call lateral recess stenosis. So there's more than just spinal stenosis. There's different types of spinal stenosis, and those are the three important types. They also have relevance as to the symptoms which occur and present. For instance, if you have spinal stenosis in the neck of the cord, you can have some cord problems as opposed to affecting a nerve root, which would be different. Now, just by going as to the symptoms, of course, we have usually pain. Patients come in most commonly with pain and commonly in radicular distribution. We have paresthesias or tingling sensation, and we have even paralysis in our patients. That's not uncommon. I have seen physicians that present with paralysis that they're unaware of because they consider, for instance, a heaviness in the leg or an arm. And so we ask our patients sometimes, do they have heaviness? Not just, are they paralyzed? Because if you have partial paralysis, sometimes you don't realize it. If it's in a cervical spine, they may develop a central cord syndrome. For instance, they may have weakness or tingling or numbness in the upper extremities, much more than in the lower extremities. And that may be urgent for a patient to have decompressed. Now, having said this, not all patients are necessarily surgical. For instance, the radiologist may very accurately describe neurofibromatous stenosis, even generalized stenosis, which he measures on his computer. But clinically, they may be mild or irrelevant. Even some severe stenosis is irrelevant to the patient's complaints. So frequently, we begin conservative care. Now, that may be the typical NSAIDs, muscle relaxant pain medicines, or it could be an epidural block. The vast majority of our patients, however, can be helped, and that's the fantastic thing about this diagnosis. It's not evil. It's something that usually can be treated very nicely. Now, just to go further, if you will, we usually start with an MRI scan, and we prefer a closed unit rather than open unit for accuracy and resolution. Sometimes we do flexion extension X-rays, especially if there's a little subluxation or offset of the vertebral bodies. And at the Greystone Neuroscience Center, we can even do myelograms and CAT scans. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, it absolutely does, and I was going to ask you about diagnosis, so you got right in there. Do you sometimes use injection therapy to diagnose exactly where it is or to kind of gauge whether it helps with the pain?
Well, pain management is a specialty unto itself, and of course we'd send the patients for that to a pain management specialist, but they do blocks, and there's different types, as you know. There's epidural blocks, facet blocks, there's RF lesioning, and sometimes for our patients that have profound pain and are not surgical, especially if they've had this pain and it's severe for a long, long time, there's something called a spinal stimulator, epidural stimulator. These stimulators can be placed and have been placed for many years. I've used them for about 45 years in patients, and they can be effective in 50 to 72% of patients, according to literature. Now, we don't want to put something inside the spine unless we have no other option by way of treating the cause. But that does mask the pain in a significant number of patients. So it is one option and probably one of the final options if all else fails.
Speak about those surgical options now, Dr. Stainer. And when does the conversation become surgical? This is for other physicians. So what would you like them to know about starting that conversation and referring to someone such as yourself?
Well, I think anybody that has diagnosed spinal stenosis and has pain or paresthesia, especially pain and paralysis, we need to see. Where we begin is looking at all the patient modifiers. For instance, how long have they had the pain? If they've had the pain a very short time, conservative therapy is almost certainly an option. There are many variables, however, that have to be taken into account. For instance, if we're considering surgery, are they on anticoagulants? Are they on immune suppressants? They would have to come off these for a surgical intervention, and we'd have to get clearance from their physicians. If they have a medical condition, a cardiac, pulmonary, we'd like to get medical permission for possible surgery. Sometimes age, osteoporosis, all these factors go into our decision-making process. If they have a pacemaker, obviously they can't have an MRI scan. If they're an anticoagulant, we can't do a myelogram or CAT scan, and we may have to simply rely on a CAT scan or other diagnostic procedures. Even social events can be important. My daughter's getting married next month. I'm in severe pain. What can I do? Well, in that case, even though surgery might be an option for the patient and the best option, we may refer to a pain management specialist and say, let's get some blocks first and see if we can get you over that next month or two, and then consider surgery. So surgery is an option for a number of patients that fail conservative therapy. And surgery is very successful for the majority of patients, we're happy to say.
So speak about those outcomes. What have you been seeing if you're talking about cervical stenosis surgery or, as you said, thoracic or lumbar? Are you getting good outcomes in the surgeries today? And what do you see changing in the surgical field for spine surgery today? You know, it's changed so much over the years with minimally invasive. Tell us some of the changes that you've seen and some of the outcomes that you've seen.
Well, it's one of the more dramatic and pleasing things for a patient to have if you're going to have to see a physician, I guess. We've had patients who came in quadriplegic and really went home walking and ambulating, even when they're elderly, say, for instance, with cervical stenosis. Now, that can't be promised all the time, and what we usually say to a patient is we're going to do the surgery if you're quadriplegic to try to prevent you from getting worse. But I will tell you that sometimes, even in recovery room, when I've done my patients, these patients woke up with their strength back, even though their weakness was present for some months. Obviously, that's not for all patients. Patients who've had that for years and ignored this condition, which is seldom, but because it's pretty dramatic, would have a much poorer prognosis. But patients with pain, prolonged pain, they're some of the happiest patients we have. They come back and say, I've had this pain for years, and their usual comment is, I should have had this years ago. And they're right. Maybe she should have had this years ago, because it's not worth dealing with the pain if there's a surgical treatment that can be done safely. And we go over the limitations. We tell them there are some risks. There are some things. But if it looks good, the odds are greatly on their side for this condition the majority of times. And in fact, usually the limitation is more medical than surgical. Now, I will tell you this. Throughout my career, and I've been did private practice for 38 years, 2 years at UAB, I've always done minimally invasive surgery. And that sounds funny because we think of it as being something that's just in the last 5 or 10 years. At one time, we used to do kind of papain injections. then percutaneous nucleotome injections, all for the spine. At the end, I was doing outpatient fusion surgery, which I think is where we're headed at this time again. This is still not caught up with the mainstream. But the more and more minimally invasive procedures are being presented to patients. Now, having said that, sometimes a minimally invasive procedure is not the best option. And I tell patients, look, we're here to do a great job on you. It's kind of like making a model of a sailing ship, and we want to make it perfect. We can do it in a bottle, but maybe we should do it outside the bottle, and that means that we can address the issue more accurately. We still will use the operating microscope almost always, but rather than doing minimally invasive, sometimes an open procedure in the usual fashion might be preferred for various reasons. So more and more, we are going in the direction of minimally invasive fusions. I mean, we hear a lot about that, minimally invasive other surgery on the spine, and I'm sure that's the future. Stem cells, other treatments are still on the horizon. I don't think they've been accepted. I don't think there's definite proof that they work yet, but there's tremendous advantages coming up down the line for all our patients, hopefully in the next 10 years.
So in summary, Dr. Stainer, what a fascinating segment and a fascinating field that you're in. Tell other physicians what you'd like them to know about spinal stenosis, when to refer, and if there's any treatments that you would like them to know about that you're doing at UAB.
You know, I think one of the things we should mention to the physicians is that if they have access to a website, just like I do, is if these patients come in and they're concerned about the condition, UAB now has animations on their website, for instance, for stenosis, or if they have unstable spine, for instance, the spine is deteriorated because they have such degeneration of their joints. They have subluxation and the spine is unstable. We're talking about a fusion. These videos are online. They show animations of screw placement, of cage placement, which is called T-lifts. And so they can look on our website online and see wonderful presentations at home. And then they can call back and ask questions later. You know, a fully informed patient is one that's more at ease. And I think that we handle the patients very efficiently, and that makes them happy. Also, the neurosurgeons downtown happy, who want to make sure that they have everything evaluated before they see the patient, if at all possible. So we kind of interface between the primary care and the other specialists and the eventual physician that would proceed to perform the surgery. It's very effective, and we can get them in faster. And patients seem to like that. It's a very pleasant surroundings in the suburbs right now. So good parking, all the accoutrements that a patient likes to have without all the confusion and hustle bustle maybe of a major medical center. We also have, coming this summer months, we're going to have a 3T wide bore scanner at the Greystone Neuroscience Center, which will be excellent for our patients that are claustrophobic, but they obviously need a high-resolution scanner. And most open scanners right now are very low resolution compared to the closed scanners. So this will be an extreme advantage for patients who want to have a high-resolution scan that is not claustrophobic. And that should be coming in line sometime about August.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stainer, for all the great work that you're doing and for this fascinating segment and sharing your expertise, telling us about the campus. Thank you again for joining us. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physicians. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.